back after dinner. We are going to start the after dinner part with a religion and politics panel. So with the presidential election underway, we find it more important than ever to discuss religion and politics. Here today to discuss just that is Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Howard Schweber and Charles Cohen, who are both professors here at UW-Madison. Moderating the panel today is AHA's Vice President, Sam Erickson.
Hello, everyone. As Nicole mentioned, my name is Sam Erickson. I'm the Vice President of Atheists, Humanists, and Agnostics here at UW-Madison. You may recognize me as the MC of Freethought Fest 3 and 4. Tonight we have the esteemed privilege of having three wonderful guests on this panel about the topic of religion in politics. We have chosen four broad subtopics underneath that which we will be discussing tonight. You can see those on the screen behind me. They are the Founding Fathers, the American political, in general, American political attitudes, and the Supreme Court, and how religion plays a role in democracy. So now I will hand the microphones off to these three gentlemen who will introduce themselves.
I'm Charles Cohen. I'm a professor of history and a member of the religious studies program. I was brought here a long time ago to teach early American history. I've taught American religious history. I developed the religious studies program here and then became the director of the Lubar Institute for the Study of the Abrahamic Religions. I'm currently working, co-editing a book on Nostra Aetate, the Vatican II Declaration, and the future of interfaith relations, and contemplating writing a book on the braided history of, an introduction to the braided histories of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
I'm Andrew Seidel. I'm an attorney at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We are a national nonprofit that works to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about matters of non-theism. I've been an attorney there working to uphold the First Amendment for 5 years now. Basically, I use my law degree to stand up to religious bullies. I am working on a book, tentatively titled Un-American, which discusses the influence or lack of influence of Christianity during the founding generation. And
I claim
I'm working on a book. It's done. We're supposed to sign a contract soon.
My name is Howard Schweber. I'm a professor of political science and legal studies. I'm also an affiliate faculty member at the law school and integrated legal studies. I'm the editor of a journal called Constitutional Studies. I teach constitutional law and the First Amendment. I wrote a book on the First Amendment. So my approach is, if Professor Cohen's expertise may be described as an academic study of religions, then Mr. Seidel's expertise may be described as the law in action. I'm on the academic legal side of things. I did practice law for 2 years, but that was a long time ago.
All right, we're going to start off with a question for Professor Cohen. So Professor Cohen, you teach a class on the American revolutionary settlement of religion. Would you care to give like a quick, maybe 2 minute summary of your entire class?
Yeah, whatever you think is wrong. That's the conclusion that my students come to from whatever position they came from. So, quickly, by the American revolutionary settlement of religion, I mean the political, constitutional, and cultural dynamics developing in the late 18th and early 19th centuries regarding the relationship of religion, politics, and the state. And I'll just throw out a few propositions. I would say by the way that there's no definitive answer as to what the settlement actually settles. But to enter into that subject, I'd say that late 18th century Americans were virtually unanimous on a couple of points. One is that religion was a good thing, that it conduced to morality, and that morality was absolutely necessary for political, social, and cultural stability. And by religion, they meant, of course, Christianity, and by Christianity, of course, they meant mainstream Protestantism. Another widely held belief was that Americans valued liberty of conscience, or if you will, freedom of religion. Now, what they may have understood by that, or how they acted on that, might have varied. But when you look not only at the federal constitution, but at the state constitutions as well, they all extol liberty of conscience. Now, those two propositions, that the belief in the goodness of religion, and particularly of Protestantism, and religious freedom, may sound as if they go easily together. I think in practice they don't always. And so Americans, beginning in the end of the 18th century and up to this very minute, have really wrestled with a dynamic of how to reconcile, in my opinion, how to reconcile those very positive values within a system that also establishes at various levels and at different times a government that I see as civil. I'll use that word as opposed to secular. But I think we have to remember that what we're talking about is a dynamic informed by history, and what was the case in the late 18th, early 19th century is not necessarily the case now, although the memories and presumed memories of those times still have an impact on us today. So I would just suggest, to begin, that the revolutionary generation sets up a series of loosely framed dynamics with which we're still wrestling today.
And how did that theory impact our founding fathers and the founding documents that they created?
Well, which theory?
The American Revolutionary Settlements of Religion in general.
Well, by settlement, I'm not calling a settlement a theory. I'm describing it as a dynamic of constitutional, political, and cultural parts. In the late 18th century, as I said, I think there are these a couple of beliefs that most Americans hold, again, the importance of religion, because they see it as absolutely essential for political stability, because it conduces to morality. But the way in which they structure different parts of their political and constitutional systems don't always bring that kind of thinking to the fore. So again, what I want to at least just lay a foundation for, because I'm sure this is going to come up as my colleagues talk about their areas as well, that there is no single answer to what the settlement did. That's why I say in my class, what my students come up with is that whatever they thought was wrong, because they've tried to pin it down to a particular part of the dynamic or a particular set of relationships and have imagined that that was true over the course of our history. It wasn't.
Sure. So to open this conversation up to the other panelists, broad question to start off. How diverse were the views of the founding fathers with regards to religion? And how did that impact the founding of our nation?
It's worth remembering that, just if you ask today Americans what is the meaning of some biblical concept, you get 1,000 different answers. You disagree broadly about these things. The same thing was true historically as well. There was a broad range of opinions. People differed. So if you want to draw a line from a spectrum from John Adams to Thomas Jefferson, Jefferson referred to Christianity as a pernicious myth that had been foisted on people to keep them in darkness and ignorance. Adams was a true believer. a small R Republican of the First Order, as Mr. Cohen was just saying, was deeply devoted to the notion that only Protestant Christians had the virtues that were necessary for a democratic republic to succeed. And there was every possible range of opinions in between. One thing I've always found particularly interesting is to compare three early documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Northwest Ordinance, and the Constitution. These are three documents written over the space of 10 years. Each is a profoundly important declaration of principles of governance. And it's very interesting how each deals with religion. So, under the influence of a particular New Jersey minister, in fact, the Declaration of Independence has a couple of explicit theological or theistic references. Reference to the Creator, reference to providence. The Northwest Ordinance doesn't, but it does have a reference to religion. That's an interesting distinction. It doesn't refer to God or providence, but it says, because religion is a good thing, just as Professor Cohen was saying, we encourage these new territories to engage in religious education. And in the Constitution, of course, there's no reference whatsoever. And that wasn't an accident. It was debated. People at the Constitutional Convention said, if we don't include a reference to God in this document, it'll be doomed. But there was a deliberate decision to leave any religious references out of the document. Which tells you something about a moment of the settlement that Professor Cohen was talking about, and a particularly important document. But more interestingly, I think it illustrates the wrestling that was going on with how to deal with claims of religious authority or religious prominence in foundational documents, and from the Declaration to the Northwest Ordinance to the Constitution, you see this very interesting progression.
I'll add a few things to that. One, I think that the idea that the founders viewed religion as important or the source of morality might be, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, might be a little bit off. I think
actually you're wrong.
I think they thought that religion was important for many people to behave morally. But I think that's a distinct assertion from saying that religion is the source of morality. And I think if you look at many of their writings, that they themselves were not as religious as many of the other people. I think there's probably a good argument to be made that they themselves shunned much of organized religion. And they believed that they had the time and the effort and the libraries to think about morality on its own without the aid of religion. But that many of the people, the lowly crowd, were not able to do that. And they needed religion to behave morally, and therefore you needed religion in a society so that the society wouldn't collapse, including here. So I take a little bit issue there. I think Gordon Wood has a good argument for that in Revolutionary Characters, if you want to read more on it, or you can get my book later. And as far as the Constitution, and I mean, one of the things that is striking about the Constitution is that it is a godless document. In its original form, it mentions religion once in Article 6, Section 3, where it prohibits religious test clauses for public office. And if you read that, that is the most emphatic statement in the entire document. There's no way around it. They were very clear. Joseph Story, one of the Supreme Court justices later, said that the purpose of that provision was to cut off every pretense between religion and government. And I think the First Amendment just later on helps to do that. And I would actually expand the freedom of conscience even to the freedom of thought. If you look at the rights protected in the First Amendment, I say six rights, many people say five. Secular government, free exercise of religion, press, speech, assembly, and to petition your government for a redress of grievances. These are about protecting people's ability to think for themselves and to have a discourse about those thoughts. And I think that was that sort of what we call now the separation of state and church, based on Thomas Jefferson's letter, I think is the thing that is uniquely American, and the thing that the founders gave a bequeath to history that is just more enormous and ground-shaking than anything else.
Professor Cohen, would you like to respond to this first?
Yeah, simply, I think that everyone, by founders, right, Jefferson, Franklin, people who were deists, whatever that may mean, fine, and they absolutely were. Washington was probably one of the least religious at least in any kind of active sense among the framers. In his farewell address, he says religion is absolutely essential to morality. It's not a question of what they may have believed as individuals themselves. This is a truism in late 18th century political thought in the United States. That's,
well, I think the phrase he uses is actually religion and morality, which I think bolsters the idea that they're different. And that was written by Alexander Hamilton, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Hamilton didn't, he contributed to the farewell address. I think we read it differently. What I'm saying is I think it's quite axiomatic, regardless of, and it's certainly true, I would agree absolutely, that we don't want to make the mistake of categorizing the framers, whoever the framers were, by the way. Should we include the state legislators? I think we should. Should we include the people who wrote the state constitutions? I think we could. I think we should. I mean, it's much broader than that. So I've just suggested a couple of what I think are axioms in the late 18th century for understanding that that period and the broader political culture surrounding the framing. I would also agree, as you said, that the Constitution does not mention God. I once had it was a very quick email exchange because these things drive me crazy about someone who insisted that because the Constitution is dated anno domini, that's a reference to God. And I said, well, okay, there are some arguments you can't win.
I've had that one many times.
I'm sticking with the proposition that there was a range of opinions in the late 18th century, and if you want to cherry pick, you can, to make any case you like. Mr. Cohen is absolutely right when he uses a term like conscience being axiomatic, but what I think he means by that, I don't want to put words in his mouth, what I would mean by that is there was a predominant way of thinking that was popularly and widely accepted. But once we get down to any particular individuals, particularly some set of individuals whom we call the framers, each one of these was an interesting and thoughtful individual with opinions of their own that they did not agree with each other.
Yeah, it's a convenient shorthand term, but I think it gets thrown around too much. They were divided on just about everything.
All right, last question on this topic. Howard, you mentioned a little bit about the importance of each individual founding document. Andrew, in the past, I've heard you say that the Constitution is the founding document of our nation. And that the wording in the Declaration of Independence about religion should therefore doesn't necessarily mean as much as the godless constitution. I was wondering, Howard, what your opinion about that might be.
Actually, I'm going to do what academics always do, which is ignore the question and answer the question that I prefer to talk about. This is what you're trained. There is an interesting and fruitful debate about the significance of the Declaration of Independence and its relative importance. What's striking to me, though, what I find that public audiences often don't realize, is how modern the First Amendment is. And I don't mean that in some sort of coy or clever way. It's only in the 1940s, for the very first time, that anybody, anywhere, suggested the First Amendment applies to the states. It's only the 1960s that we have the full application of the various clauses of the First Amendment to the states. Basically, in my lifetime, I'm old, but still, in my lifetime is the entire history of the First Amendment. Because look, if it doesn't apply to the states, it doesn't mean very much. Prior to the 1960s, and certainly prior to the 1940s, it's absolutely orthodox understanding. I'm not being radical, I'm not being clever, I'm not being conspiratorial, to say that the state of Wisconsin could ban all religions other than Catholicism, if it wanted to. The state of Wisconsin could put you in prison for the wrong political opinions, or close newspapers. Those of you who in high school studied the Alien and Sedition Acts, we had learned that Madison and Jefferson were big free press advocates. He had not so much. In his second inaugural address, Jefferson called on state governors to close down Federalist newspapers that were criticizing his administration. They didn't want the federal government to have that authority, and that's not the same thing. It's not a liberty. It's not a right. This is protected against all forms of government, and that's very, very modern. So one of the problems that I have with this whole conversation in talking about the framers and the founding generation and so on is that, to me, it seems wildly anachronistic, given that literally it's only in my own lifetime that the very idea that the First Amendment protects anybody's rights to anything has been in play at all. Given that historical situation, again, I'm not being clever, this is basic orthodoxy, this is not some sort of weird conspiracy theory. Given that fact, given the fact that, I'm going to add another gloss, if I might, the manner, the way in which the First Amendment has been applied to all of us is by way of the 14th Amendment, which was adopted in the 1870s. So if you want to speak about some sort of originalism in the first place, I think we should talk about the 1870s. In the second place, we might want to talk about the 1840s. It just gets very, very difficult for me to understand how to make these genuinely fascinating historical arguments applicable to current issues of constitutional doctrine, given how recent these debates really are.
Andrew, I'll give you 30 seconds to respond if you want.
30 seconds to respond. My point earlier was that what you were suggesting is that the Declaration of Independence is not a document that founded a government. It severed our political connection from Great Britain. It did not institute its own government. It was a justification to a candid world for our rebellion. But the Constitution is what actually formed the United States, as we came to know them. That's the point that I was trying to make, I think, that you were touching on. And the four references to religion in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, that was the only one that Jefferson actually included in the original draft. Their creator was probably added by Franklin and Adams in the editing process, and then divine providence and supreme judge of the world were added later on.
What's that? Religious.
Yeah, most likely. Added later on in the editing process in the full Continental Congress. And so yes, I think those have less relevance to, especially since there was no First Amendment, there was no Constitution, less relevance to constitutional law and the founding than the Constitution itself.
Sure, thank you. So moving on to our second topic, the role of religion in American political behavior and attitudes. Considering that roughly 20 to 25% of our country is now secular, why is faith and religion still such a large part of running for office?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I don't know. There's this voter-imposed religious test for public office. You know, so there's this auto-da-fe that I find very frustrating. And if you look at studies that have been done for a hypothetical candidate for public office, otherwise qualified for that office, what are the things that will cause you not to vote for them? Being a woman, being of a certain race, being gay. Atheist is always at the bottom of that poll. It's one of the things that is the biggest political liability for any person to come out of the closet. So we're seeing it a little bit at state levels. Pete Stark was an atheist in Congress. He no longer holds that seat, so there's nobody that we know of at the Congress or higher level, which just statistically is not the case. 7% of the country are atheists and agnostics, as Sam mentioned, nearly a third are non-religious, and that number goes up with education, and overall Congress is more educated, so you expect to see a little bit more, and there are none. Disturbing.
Well, there are a couple ways to talk about this question, although I can't help but flash back 4 years ago, the previous presidential election, when I noticed that during one of the Republican debates, five people on the stage each declared that God had personally told them that they were meant to be president, which I thought was an interesting potential theological conflict, aside from anything else. As I say, a couple ways to answer. So one of my professions is political science, and as a political scientist, I would answer this by pointing out that both parties' bases involve highly vocal, highly mobilizable, and loyal voter groups who take religion very seriously. It doesn't matter if they're a minority of the country, they are critical voting blocks that form the base of support for both parties. Right? So there's that. Secondly, I think Professor Kahn is right that to this day, even people who describe themselves as non-religious, somehow, and it's a mystery, but it's an observable mystery, want their leaders to profess to be religious. That is, whether or not we think about ourselves that our morality depends on religion, somehow we believe of our candidates that their morality might depend on their religion. It's also a signpost for respectability. There's a whole series of class and cultural references tied into being church going.
There's a question of whether or not it should be.
I don't use the word should. And there's a reason for that. As I said, I'm speaking as a political scientist, just observing the phenomenon. I mean, a very interesting question right now is, you know, for a national candidate for office, would it be more disadvantageous to be publicly viewed as an atheist or as a Muslim? I think it's an interesting question. So, you know, these things morph. They change over time. The fact that Bernie Sanders is running for president, no one is making a very big deal, but the fact that he's Jewish is quite startling to those of us who are of a certain age. But it's quite interesting. It would not have been true 30 years ago. So, you know, there are changes. Moving away from the political science side of things, or perhaps the somewhat more normative side of things, there has always been a profound disconnect between the principles that govern our political behavior in this country and the political principles to which we aspire in constitutional terms. And you can argue that's a bad thing, you can say lots of things about that, but there's always been this difference. And there have always been candidates and parties and movements that have played upon that difference. And one of the many, many complicated questions that arises out of recognizing that fact is about the role of courts and the role of things like the First Amendment. There is a widely held, I think, utterly, completely sound and sensible notion that it is the purpose of courts to enforce the First Amendment and to preserve some kind of a separation between religion and politics. I think that's absolutely sound. It's also wildly unpopular. But that distinction between popular will and constitutional principle has always been the bedrock of our politics. When you look at candidates running for office, that's very much a one-sided aspect.
If I could take a quick stab at this point. One thing that's already been mentioned is that while the First Amendment prohibits the federal government from imposing and through adjudication now, though not in through much of our history, the states, from imposing a religious test, we get to do it all the time. And guess what? We do. There's nothing unconstitutional about any voter imposing a religious test on a candidate. I would say that the answer, or an answer to this conundrum, is again historical and cultural. The deep sense of identification in American nationalism, that the United States has a special relationship with God, ideas that go back to 17th century Puritanism and get worked out in a variety of ways in such ideologies as Manifest Destiny and so on. That's not provable, at least as far as I can tell, but culturally and historically, it's very important. And I think that, again, I can't quite prove this, but I have an intuition, I've said this to my class, that American politicians speak Protestant. That Protestant language, because of its deep imbrication in the founding period, where ideas, you know, could be shared by various strains of dominant Protestantism and by civil humanism or small-R republicanism, they go back and forth, that this sense of identity, destiny, it now may be secularized more that, you know, USA, USA, we're special, but the background to that sense of specialness is religious and framed in religious terms. So we are, as far as I know, the only nation that puts God on our money. Other people may, other countries may put religious leaders, but we have God. And that should tell you something about some of the strains in our political and religious culture. One last thing, over a decade ago I was lecturing in Japan. This is just after the United States had invaded Iraq, so I was made to stand for American policy since I was there. And the Japanese had a hard time, understandably, given...
I know some Jordan, which is even more fun.
Saying, well, Bush is always talking about God, you know, what's with him? And I said, well, he's an American politician. Every American, or almost every American politician, talks about God. It's part of the political language. Whether it should be is a different question, but I think it's deeply rooted, and that's why, and we're also at a stage now, we have not always in our history been demanding of our presidential candidates that they show their religiosity. This is not a permanent condition, but over the past 30 years, it has raised itself again, I think again, for a variety of reasons.
I'm sorry, I'd like to add a gloss to that, if I might, which is that at different points in history, this comes and goes. The 30-year point reference is a key one. In the late 1970s, we had Jimmy Carter, and then in the early 1980s, we had Ronald Reagan, and those two men, as candidates, ushered in a reintroduction of religious language in our politics that had been largely missing for the previous 50 years. If you look at the speeches of Richard Nixon, not a beloved figure for liberals, but you'll be startled at how utterly secular they were. There was no reference to religion of any kind in the speeches. And of course, there's the famous speech that John Kennedy gave in Houston to Baptist ministers where he said, I'm not a Catholic candidate. These things do come and go. If you go back further into the 40s and 50s, during the Cold War, a certain association of American secularism with Christianity was promoted by the idea of setting ourselves apart from the godless communists. Right? So there are periods in which this comes and goes. We're an extraordinarily, intensely religious period in our politics now. It happened for the last 30 years. It's been growing and growing for 30 years since the moral majority. The Christian Coalition is probably names that don't mean much to you, but there was a time, for example, when evangelical Protestants, by and large, didn't vote. As a community, the dominant view was that voting and participating in politics were matters not appropriate for deeply believing Protestants to participate in. It's only since 1980 that the idea of evangelical Protestants as a voting bloc, to which one of the parties or the other might appeal, has been part of the political calculus. Why we're in this particular position at the moment has to do, I think, with things like districting and polarization and parties, and certainly the current perceived threat of Islamic terrorism lends itself very, very neatly to religious formulation of identity. But causes are, when I'm talking about history, I try to avoid causal explanations.
Well, that's why you're a political scientist.
Andrew, real quick, just keep it short.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll see. So, that's it. Of all the candidates that were talked to by God and told to run for president, one of them was our governor here. And under state open records laws, you are actually allowed to request records of any communications between any government official and anybody else. And at FFRF, we requested all the communications between Governor Scott Walker and any deity which he might have had, and it turns out there were none.
Yeah, I did that right.
Moving on to our third topic. What is the Supreme Court's view of the relationship between church and state, and how has that changed over time? Howard, you can have the first word if you want as a con law professor.
30 seconds or less, right?
Well, no, you can not for this one.
Oh, 2 minutes. All right, cool. So as I mentioned, this is a conversation that doesn't begin in the 1940s, doesn't really begin in the 1960s, which is good news. It's a much shorter story than you might have feared. But there has been a sea change, a dramatic change in the overall thinking that the court has exhibited toward the religion clauses. from a period from the 1950s, 60s, 70s, to the middle 80s, and then a period from the 90s and forward. And there are a lot of things I can point to, and people want to talk about this in more technical terms later, I'm happy to do some cases and so on. But here's the big one that I think is important. Up until the 1990s, let's say around 2000 actually, there was a dominant notion in the Supreme Court that what the First Amendment required of government was neutrality. And that neutrality meant being neither pro-religious nor anti-religious. It meant being essentially secular, taking no position on religious questions. And the notion, and there's a long historical notion as to why that should be true. And the argument is that the two clauses, the religion clauses of the First Amendment, could exercise and establishment, point to the idea that religion is both specially valuable and specially dangerous. It needs to be protected against intrusions from political authorities, and we need to protect ourselves from its entering into political dialogue, political controversy. So it's both very precious and very dangerous, and therefore it's a special case. So the idea until relatively recently was, therefore, since religion is a special case, since it is specially precious and specially dangerous both, it must be simply left out of the political discussion, and the proper position of the government is to be neutral, meaning secular. Starting in, and we can argue about the date, I'm going to use 2000, but I could easily take this back to something in the 90s. No, post-Lemon. A different view emerged. The different view says that the absence of religion sends an anti-religious message. So there are not three positions, pro-religious, anti-religious, or neutral. There are only two, pro or anti. And if there are only two, then what neutrality requires is equal access to the public square for both. And so the modern Supreme Court doctrine rejects the idea that there exists such a thing as secularism as neutrality, neither pro-religious nor anti-religious, and adopts a kind of an interest group model that says the world is divided into religious people and non-religious people, or people of one religion and people of another religion, and the role of government is to be a fair arbiter between them. A lot of that doctrinally has to do with using free speech doctrine to supplant what used to be religious clause doctrine, but the big message I want to convey is that we live in an era that's brand new, it's less than 20 years old, 20 at the most, in which the notion is that there's no such thing as secularism as neutrality. You're either religious or you're anti-religious, and there is no middle ground. To the extent that we accept that paradigm, then the notion of neutrality becomes allowing an equal playing, allowing religious voices equal access with non-religious voices, religious activities equal support with non-religious activities, and so on. And we've lost in our constitutional doctrine this notion of a neutral space that is neither for nor against religious belief.
I think the trend is shifting that way, and I will say that it's a bad development. Neutrality is absolutely the right principle to go on. You know, we deal with this every single day at FFRF. Just to take an example, we get probably 100 complaints every year about coaches praying with their teams at public schools. And the neutral principle would be that the coach doesn't say anything about religion and actually just teaches the kids how to play football. Or there's the pro-religion where the coach has all the kids pray. Or there's the anti-religion where the coach says, there is no God, stop worrying about it, get out there and play football. I think clearly the neutral position is the one that we want to be pushing and that we are working to fight for in the courts. It's a very difficult fight. And I'll add too that it's a politically unpopular position, and courts, though we are supposed to have an independent judiciary, are not as independent as they ought to be all the time. And one of the things they've developed to avoid making these politically unpopular decisions is the standing doctrine, which says a number of things. Basically, it says that you have to have an interest in the litigation. You have to be injured. There's a number of different factors that they look at for you to be able to sue over this violation. And it's one way that they've successfully kept a lot of these politically unpopular cases out of court. Mike Newdow brought a challenge against the phrase, under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, and he was successful at the Ninth Circuit. The Supreme Court booted him out on standing because he didn't have full custody of his kids. And that was how he was able to challenge it. So you're seeing standing become an issue a lot nowadays.
Well, to be fair, they had to. Scalia had recused himself. It was going to be 4-4.
Charles, do you have anything to say?
I certainly see the legal expertise to my colleagues, and I also agree with them both with the historical analysis and I guess with the values analysis that as a member of a religious minority, I'm very concerned about the recent jurisprudence and the way in which it's headed.
For a more recent example, will the current battle for the Supreme Court between Republicans in the Senate and President Obama impact current issues surrounding the separation of church and state? And if you want to focus more broadly, perhaps you can talk simply about how religion itself penetrates the Supreme Court or makes its way into Supreme Court jurisprudence.
We actually don't know anything about Garland's views on the separation of state and church. He hasn't really written anything about it. Actually, not very much First Amendment jurisprudence at all. So we're not. It's very difficult to predict if he is added, which way it will swing the court on many of these issues. He seems to be mostly a centrist, but then also people can shift their views pretty quickly when they get on the court. So I don't know about your political science perspective.
Well, a couple things. Number one, we have a Supreme Court that is entirely composed of Catholics and Jews. It astounds me that no one finds that surprising. There is not currently a Protestant on the court. That should be deeply startling, if not shattering, based on our history and our tradition. And I mean, this is incredible. This is bizarre. Is there some connection between being Jewish or Catholic and attitudes or Protestant attitudes about religion? Oh, I don't know. Maybe not in a deterministic way. Certainly for Justice Scalia, there was at a personal level. But you know, we have to get down to individual cases. Actually, the biggest fights about religion these days are not constitutional; they're statutory. There's a short version and a long version of this. The short version is that Congress and then the various states adopted statutes in those RFRAs, Religious Freedom and Restoration Acts. And most of the fighting going on, Hobby Lobby, for example, Hobby Lobby case, is about these statutes, not about the First Amendment. Courts play a role, they interpret statutes, they apply statutes, they enforce them, and so on. But as far as the makeup of the court matters, you know, Congress or the state legislatures could abandon these statutes tomorrow if they wanted to. These are popularly passed acts of legislation that are supported by political will and don't really require any particular constitutional analysis to support them because they are clearly within. There's no dispute that it is within the authority of Congress and the state legislatures to pass laws of this kind. That being the case, there isn't really a constitutional question.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
Senator Seidel's microphone is not on, or not on the same as the other two.
Better? I disagree with that. I think there is a good argument to be made that most of these Religious Freedom Restoration Acts are unconstitutional. The court did overturn a large section of the federal RFRA as it applied to the states. I think it's an overreach on separation of powers that I think the Supreme Court was actually afraid to strike down. It was in a response to a decision, Employment Division v. Smith in 1990, that the federal RFRA was passed. And basically in that case, there were these two Native Americans who smoked peyote and were not able to collect their unemployment benefits because they had been dismissed for drug use. And they claimed that that was their religious right.
From their jobs as drug counselors, it's kind of ironic.
And I think that's a legitimate dismissal. I think it was a legitimate law. And I think the reaction to it was a vast overreach. And if you actually look at the way the laws are written, they basically tell courts how they really need to be interpreting, although it's not labeled this way, interpreting the First Amendment. They have taken the job of the courts on themselves and legislated that. And we actually wrote, FFRF actually wrote a brief to the Supreme Court in the Hobby Lobby case arguing this very point. So if you're interested, you can go read it. They didn't listen to us, but we still think they are, for the most part, unconstitutional and are fighting them. Howard's point, though, that they are legislation and can be overturned at any time is a very good one. So if you don't like them, you should be writing to your own state legislators and, yes, voting.
Moving away from legal issues, I'd like to move on to our last topic. And I want to offer this question to Professor Cohen first. Are there appropriate limits to the role of religion in a democracy?
It's framed that way. That question is so large as to be utterly unanswerable.
Fair enough.
Role.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Are we?
What? Man enough.
That's sexist.
Would you like me to offer a more specific one?
Sure.
Do religious institutions have a right in this country to discriminate their services when they are also nonprofits?
We've gone from the very broad to the
very Okay, so I'm not a lawyer. Again, I'll leave the precise legal parsing of this to them. I will say, and going back to my reading of Hobby Lobby, that I'm very concerned about the trend now to use claims of religious freedom as ways to chip away at rights that other people have. What worries me is that the assertion, and maybe the hyper-assertion of one very valuable right might be deployed, perhaps is beginning to be deployed as a way of chipping away at other people's rights in other areas. Now, whether this can be done, I leave to people who traffic in these things. But that I fear it might be done, and in fact, I think Hobby Lobby gives. I agree with Ginsburg's dissent on this, where I think she worries about where this might be going. I'm afraid of the tendency of these kinds of procedures to chip away at citizenship and the bonds, the other kinds of bonds that hold us together as citizens. But whether it might be perfectly legal,
I think it's not, but I think you hit the nail on the head. This is the scary part of these laws. It turns, this is the way the courts have talked about it, it turns what used to be a shield into a sword. You know, your religious freedom used to be a way to protect yourself from the government, and now it's being radically redefined into a way to impose that religion on other people, your employees, your customers, things like that. And it's something that is, it's very, very scary. And I think people are starting to realize the problem with this, so I hope it's not going to end up where it could. I think everybody is kind of waking up to the dangers of these laws. You know, the ACLU was a very big proponent of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act when it came out in the early 90s, and now they have specifically said, we regret this, it was a mistake, we are against it, and we disagree with it now. So I think people are waking up.
I once, in response to a question, said that on my tombstone, I don't like the words, it's complicated. let me throw out three ideas in very, very brief terms, any one of which could be the subject of a lengthy conversation, and a couple of which I've actually written books about. Mine exists. The whole deal. Here's one idea that's worth thinking about. We're talking about rights and freedoms and using religion as a shield or a sword and all that stuff. We're talking about situations when private individuals are bound by the law in terms of their conduct. Now, that's actually very tricky, very complicated, and has a very long history. Under what circumstances, for example, do we say to a business owner, you must do business with everybody on an equal basis? We don't say you must let everyone in your living room on an equal basis. That's easy. We've never suggested you may not discriminate in terms of whom you may date we're socialized with, obviously. So there's a spectrum, and at some point, the public interest in the provision of the service becomes great enough, as it used to be called common carriers, that we say if you're in a certain kind of business, we're going to insist that as a condition for being in that business, you've got to treat everybody equally. There's only time to throw that thought out, but it is a deep, complicated question of law that doesn't, that gets overlooked. That is, in the larger context of this conversation, is under what circumstances, in general, do we regulate private behavior? Here's a second idea, which is way too big to work through, but I want to toss it out. It's sometimes called public reason. And there's a whole bunch of different theorists and versions. Here's a really, really short version. In a republic, we ought never to have laws that force people to do things for no better reason than because I say so. I'm the king, and I say so. There are more of us than there are of you, and we say so. I have reasons, but they're secret, and do it because I say so. None of these are acceptable, and this is deeply rooted in American political thought. None of these are, what's called arbitrary power is never acceptable. Well, here's the problem. If you enact a law based on religious justifications, to people who don't share that religion, that's arbitrary. That is, if I say you're going to be required to follow a certain rule, why? Well, God told me to do this. And you don't happen to share my belief that God told me to do this, then to you, this is arbitrary. So the deepest question, to my mind, about the role of religion in democracy is whether religion or religious principles are a proper justification for democratic action. And I would argue that they are not. That gets us to a very subtle and philosophical level, and it does come back to, as Charles pointed out, you know, when you vote, do you vote for people who appeal to religious justifications for their actions? And as long as it's the case that voters support those candidates, my particular theory will be nothing more than Harry philosophy, which is a book.
Relating to this, public figures frequently claim certain religious groups are genuinely affected and face sincere prosecution from new public policy. To what extent should we acknowledge their claims, and how can we tell when their religious liberty is actually being infringed upon, not just having their already existing religious privilege taken away?
I mean, I think that's a big part of what you're hearing from the evangelical and Christian majority is it's a rollback of certain privileges that they've had for a very long time that they probably should not have had in the first place. And instead of recognizing that for what it is, they are crying foul and claiming they are being persecuted. I think RFRAs are a little bit of a response to that. I've written about this kind of extensively on FFRF's blog, Free Thought Now. It's almost like the boy who cried wolf. Eventually, there are going to be some legitimate instances of persecution of Christians in this country by the government and maybe by businesses, but I don't think we've seen them today. You have people like Todd Starnes at Fox News who has written an entire book about this, and if you look at all the stories in his book, they're almost all nonsense. They've been debunked many, many times. These are not actual examples of Christians being persecuted. They're examples of Christians not being able to exercise the privilege that they once had and that they shouldn't have had in the first place.
It's worth pointing out that RFRAs have been very powerful tools to protect the religious freedoms of Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, Native Americans, non-Christians. The laws are written in terms of religion, and they protect minority religions as well as majority religion. In fact, the original RFRA was written as a response, as was mentioned, to a case called Employment Division versus Smith, in which Justice Scalia authored an opinion stating that no state is required to make accommodations for religious practices. And he said in his opinion, they're allowed to make accommodations, and the outcome will be that majority religions will get more privileges than minorities, but that's just what the cost of living in a democracy. RFRAs were a response to that, and they have, in fact, been extremely valuable to protect the interests of religious minorities. So it gets complicated. We have secular minorities and religious minorities. We have religious majorities, you know, and different kinds of minorities. We have blatantly false claims of wars on Christmas. Let's say war on Christmas. In Massachusetts, until 1700, it was a crime to celebrate Christmas because it was considered a pagan holiday. That's a war on Christmas. But we also have these same laws and these same coalitions going to work to defend minority groups. And given the precarious position of particularly Muslim communities in America today, I'm not 100% certain I want to jettison those protections too lightly.
Well, do you think the First Amendment would not cover them then? Do you think, based on the point that you're saying?
Well, as long as lawyers serve, as long as Smith is good law, and as long as that's the dominant interpretation that we have, no, we're not.
I want to end with a question for Professor Cohen.
So he's a horrible case. Yeah.
Considering past cycles of American religious decline and great awakenings, and the fact that Americans' religiosity is currently on the decline, would you say that another great awakening is around the corner, or are they over?
You never ask a historian to predict anything. Is that on?
There we go.
Okay. What I said is you never ask a historian to predict anything. I'm a little bit skeptical about the trend, though the trend showing a slight decline in religiosity over the past 7 years, if we buy the Pew figures, it is certainly real. Whether we can project that line downward, I'm not so sure. I agree with that. But I'm also not sure that we're going to get another immediate kind of evangelical awakening. It seems to me that at least, as Howard mentioned earlier, for say 50 years or so, in the middle of the 20th, for 50 years in the middle of the 20th century, many evangelical voters did not participate in politics, and they came back then, I think, in the mid-1970s for reasons I think we can probably ascertain. My sense, though I've been wrong on these things before, is that sort of the political manifestation of evangelical religion with a particularly capital R Republican slant and a conservative political thrust is perhaps being spent. And I don't expect to see that recrudescing very soon. There was an article in today's Times about Trump's rise as the least religious candidate imaginable, suggests a kind of secularization.
No, he has a Bible, though. Yeah. He's helped us.
Yeah, I mean, 2 Corinthians walking through a bar. I think I might suggest that political evangelicalism seems to be on the decline. What that may or may not mean for personal belief, I wouldn't want to predict. But we may be heading towards something of a cycle where at least the religious forces in play are different. You know, there used to be in this country a religious left. It was very active in the 1960s. It calls the civil rights movement. As a historian, I've wondered why that goes away. And I think it does go away about 1970, and we haven't seen it back. Maybe there's a time for that kind of religious politics.
One quick political comment, if I might. If you watch the Republican primaries going on right now, it is a very interesting, on this question, the issue. Ted Cruz is very specifically making his base in the evangelical community. Trump is very specifically not. It's not the case by any means that the evangelical community has ceased to be an important part of the Republican base. It's changed in this cycle as compared to the last four national or five national election cycles. It's no longer the core of the mainstream base. It's one competing group among several. So you're going to have a candidate like Cruz who appeals to that group, and another candidate like Trump doesn't particularly do so. I mean, he gets support from that community, but it's not his appeal. It's not his base. I'm actually betting on, for whatever it's worth, I'm betting on Cruz in the long run in this one, but we'll see how this plays out.
Andrew, last word if you want.
So, a couple things. One, atheists and agnostics now are about 7% of the population. That's triple the number of Mormons. And that's more than Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and Muslims combined. That's a huge shift. And I do not think that religion's dominance in this country will survive this information age that we're in, basically. It's too easy to see, go online and look up all the contradictions in the Bible and to meet other atheists, to meet other agnostics, to meet other free thinkers. And on that note, this circles back to what we were talking about with that voter-imposed religious test for public office and why atheism is such a liability for political candidates right now. So if you are a non-religious person in the audience, or an atheist or an agnostic, and I would encourage you to come out of the closet. This is one of the biggest ways that we are going to shift that unpopularity. It's because people don't know that they know an atheist and that they're not baby-eating monsters. They're just normal, just normal people who are just like you and me. So I would really encourage you, if you are, to be out and proud about it.
If I can share a very short anecdote. My daughter was 6 years old. I don't have the microphone. You all can hear me pretty well, I think. I do this for a living. My daughter was 6 years old. She came home from Hebrew school having learned the creation story in the book of Genesis. And I told her my very short version of the theory of evolution. And she thought about it for a minute. She said, "That's okay, Daddy. You don't believe in God, but Mommy does." And off she went. At the time, I was kind of nonplussed, but in retrospect, that's probably a pretty okay resolution of that particular potential issue.
Please give it up for our lovely.